Mouth.
Word of 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 mouth.
Mouth.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. In a nation that values achievement, George Plimpton failed fabulously.
For those of you who haven't heard of Plimpton, it's a little difficult to know where to begin an introduction. Plimpton's a writer. He is an editor of the Paris Review. And after that, he's a collector of experiences. Experiences like boxing Archie Moore, playing quarterback for the Detroit Lions, or percussion for the New York Philharmonic. The list could go on and on. It's obvious, of course, that no one could be that good. And Plimpton certainly isn't.
60 years after he helped launch the Paris Review, and 10 years after his death, George Plimpton does what he does best, plays himself in a new documentary. The man who threw himself into the ring with a professional boxer, played goalie for the Bruins, and quarterback for the Detroit Lions, effectively created the participatory journalism genre, giving mere mortals a glimpse of what it was like to play with the Giants. Filmmakers Tom Bean and Luke Poling combed through hours of footage to create a film of clear adoration, posthumously narrated by its own subject. Plimpton, starring George Plimpton as himself, is already out in select theaters. It opens Friday, June 21st at the Coolidge Corner Theater in Brookline, Massachusetts. And Tom Bean, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Luke, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having us on.
Well, George Plimpton came into the world with quite a heavy legacy. He came from this very patrician family, probably responsible for that very distinctive voice. But he never quite lived up to his family's, or certainly his father's, expectations. What kind of effect did that have on him?
Everyone says that he didn't live up to his father's expectations. But really, when you look at what he accomplished in his life, I don't know what parent was expecting their child to play horseshoes with the president and appear as himself on The Simpsons and do all the other amazing things that George did throughout his life. His father came from he was a lawyer at a very large firm in New York, and George kind of went another path.
Tell us a little bit about his art of fiction, which was really his invention for the Paris Review, something that in your film, Philip Gurevich says, a genre he really invented.
The Paris Review interview has long been the kind of culminating interview of an artist's career, because they don't simply sit down and ask a question and transcribe it and print it. What they do is they collaborate with the artist themselves. So the Kurt Vonnegut interview, for example, took 10 years to do. The writer who they're interviewing edits what they say. The idea isn't to catch them out. The idea is to have them say their definitive piece about their craft. And they only pick people who are kind of later in their career, canonical writers. They kind of enter the canon when they do their Paris Review interview. Immediately, everyone copied it. Obviously, the Playboy interview, the Esquire interview, this kind of Q&A style where you transcribe it and print it, that became a widely adopted format that George essentially created in 1953.
One of the interviews that was really represented the coup for him was with Ernest Hemingway. Here he is telling an audience about the experience of that interview.
I said, Papa, what's the symbol of the white birds that seem to appear in so many of your sex scenes? And it was as if I'd stuck him with a pin. He turned red with sort of with rage. And I put down the picnic hamper somewhat alarmed. And he shouted at me, so you could hear it for half a mile. He shouted at me, so you think you can do better? I, at this time, had written a children's book called The Rabbit's Umbrella. He had written he was a Nobel Prize winner, so there's really no way that I could answer this, this question.
We hear in the film about George's sort of search for his father or papa. What did that interview mean for him, do you think?
I think George certainly looked up to Hemingway and admired him, as so many writers of that era did. In fact, I think a lot of them really ended up in Paris because they wanted to, you know, like Gay Talese says in the film, emulate people like Hemingway and Fitzgerald and the generation before him. So for him to get Hemingway, who was notoriously reticent to talk at all about his craft, and really to get what ended up being the one really big interview that Hemingway gave in his life, for George, I think it was a huge success. And especially at that time, I believe it appeared originally in issue 16 or 17. So the magazine had been around for a couple years, but maybe didn't have the status that it has today. James Salter, one of the people we interviewed, said that, you know, their list of people who have done it is as prestigious as, you know, the Nobel Prize for Literature or the Pulitzer.
James Salter is one of these people who has some criticism for the other side of George Plimpton, which was this much showier, the participatory journalist, the man who was writing for Sports Illustrated and throwing himself into these experiences. Tell us about his first foray into participatory journalism.
So George, when he moved back from Paris after founding the magazine to New York, he started writing for Sports Illustrated, which was a fairly new magazine at the time and had huge literary credentials. I mean, people like Faulkner were writing pieces. It was an era of adopting literary forms to popular genres like sport. And George threw himself into this gleefully. He was really excited about participating. What he was hoping to achieve, clearly, was to get inside the huddle. He wanted to illuminate the closed worlds of performative genius from within and discover the talent it took to do it, the skill, the hard work. And his very first piece was to pitch at a baseball all-star game at Yankee Stadium, which he claimed was every young American boy's dream. And he gets in there and he gets Willie Mays to pop out and he decides, gosh, this is it. You know, I've made it. I'm going to be a pitcher. And then, you know, Ernie Banks hits a line drive. And then this guy, Frank Thomas, who played for the Pirates, you know, took him to the upper deck of Yankee Stadium. And George just stood there flabbergasted, his arm about to fall off, just saying, well, I guess that's why they're the pros, you know? And so he wrote this wonderful essay for Sports Illustrated. He turned that into a book called Out of My League, which actually he got Hemingway to blurb. George, as a humorist, had the good sense to set himself up to fail. And it created this neat story arc where he could get into the world, he could learn about what it took to participate, he could learn from the people, and then he failed and he had this great story arc, whether it was baseball or the New York Philharmonic or the circus or whatever it was.
And he also fought with the light heavyweight champ of the world, Archie Moore, a man known as Mr. Mongoose. Here is George Plimpton recounting that story. This is from the film Plimpton.
Well, as you can see, I am not properly constituted to fight. I have a very thin, delicate nose which bleeds. And not only that, but I suffer from something called sympathetic response, which means that if you're hit, you weep. Well, the fight started. And in the first round, Mr. Moore made these really very aggressive moves and stuck out a couple of extremely stiff jabs. There was an enormous amount of sympathetic response. And I think it sort of startled Archie Moore. He'd never been in the ring with somebody both bleeding and weeping at the same time. And sympathy overwhelmed him. Kept hauling me up. He kept whispering in my ear, breathe, man, breathe.
That's a clip from the film Plimpton, starring George Plimpton as himself. I'm speaking to directors Tom Bean and Luke Poling about the movie and about the colorful, wonderful character that is George Plimpton. Why do you think that so many people were following these kind of crazy antics?
You know, George said at one point that the vast majority of American males put themselves to sleep at night striking out the Yankees batting order. And it's something that when you watch the game on TV or even in person, you're always looking at it thinking, well, I could have thrown that pass. That wasn't that great a catch, or that goal wasn't that spectacular. But George, going in there and actually putting his neck on the line, you see very clearly that it does take a special talent and a special skill to be able to work in these worlds. And George had definitely an innate athletic ability, but, you know, very quickly showed that it was nowhere near what these other professionals had. And on top of that, I think he really did a great job of bringing you into the huddle. He talks in Paper Lion about literally standing in the huddle and seeing all these pairs of shoes pointing at him, looking for him to make a decision. And for sports fans to be able to read any of his books and feel like you are in the locker room with the Bruins or you're on the field with the Lions, it's a kind of immersive journalism that's kind of new. And George, he's kind of the perfect person to take you by the hand and lead you into this very exciting and very interesting kind of closed world that you hadn't seen from that angle before.
One experience that George never talked about was being with Bobby Kennedy when he was shot. You get tape of his deposition to, I'm guessing it's the Los Angeles Police Department. Let's hear just a bit from that.
Could you describe him?
Curious. Being a writer, I think one would know these things, and yet, goddammit, I can't tell you. I think his shirt was yellow brown, but if you tell me it wasn't, I wouldn't be the slightest bit surprised. I can tell you all about his eyes. They were dark brown, enormously peaceful eyes.
Why do you think he never talked about that story? You know, perhaps the strongest experience or the most powerful experience in anybody's life that I can imagine.
I think it was just devastating for him. I mean, like that clip you just played, you can clearly hear how utterly destroyed George is from having witnessed this. And he was good friends with the Kennedys. He dated Jackie when they were teenagers. He was in the same graduating class at Harvard with RFK and was appearing on the campaign trail for him, you know, that the year he was assassinated. And the other things that George wrote about were all things that he kind of knowingly and willingly undertook. And this was something just so horrific and so terrible. I think it was difficult for him to really process it. And the amount of time and effort you would have to spend thinking about it and really trying to verbalize it and put it down on paper, I think just proved to be perhaps too painful for him to relive.
Another role that he, I think, had some difficulty playing was as a husband and a father and even a brother. Members of his family, both his first wife, Freddie, second wife, Sarah Dudley Plimpton, his son, his daughter, his sister, most all of them comment about George seemed to belong to everybody. He loved the party. He loved to be the center of attention, but intimacy was a little bit more challenging for him. As you guys made the movie and went through all of these hours and hours of George Plimpton tape and lines of text, what was holding him back?
Well, I think, you know, George as the great extrovert also means he's slightly aloof from certain elements of his life. I think the flip side of the guy who goes everywhere, does everything, knows everyone, is that he doesn't have an opportunity as a person to spend a whole lot of time with, you know, one group of people or one person. You know, everyone said he was an affectionate man and a loving father, a very supportive father. But I think that because he was always on the fly, being George Plimpton, I think that may have left a certain space there that, I don't know, perhaps left his family members and even his other friends kind of wanting more.
We're speaking with Tom Bean and Luke Poling. They are the filmmakers behind the film Plimpton, starring George Plimpton as himself. It's a new documentary. George Plimpton was extremely successful at leveraging the medium of television, both in his documentary and TV specials, you know, where he'd go off to Africa and be a photographer, where he would, you know, be in a John Wayne movie or joining the New York Philharmonic as a percussionist. They would make television specials about this. Became very well known for that. Also, later in his life, he was supporting the Paris Review and his other projects by making commercials.
I'll try almost anything. So when Mattel Electronics asked me to compare their Intellivision games with Atari, I gave it a try. I compared Atari baseball with Intellivision and found Intellivision played much more like real baseball.
Then I compared. This is a part of his life that a number of writers, you know, who would die to get into the Paris Review, probably considered a little bit less than savory. He's accused in the film of being a dilettante, a dabbler. James Salter suggests that he was sort of limiting himself by writing in a genre that doesn't permit greatness. On the other side of things, we hear his second wife say he was a performance artist. You know, he just did everything. What are your observations of that as filmmakers?
Well, I think the premise of George being a dilettante is rested on the false premise that the participation was the end result. And I think that if he just, you know, stormed in and pitched at Yankee Stadium and that was it, you know, yeah, that's dabbling in dilettantism. But, you know, what he did is he used the experience as a device to write. And he was a terrific writer. And moreover, George was part of a movement of journalism, now called New Journalism, or even called then at the time by Tom Wolfe, and his contemporaries, Hunter Thompson, Joan Didion, Tom Wolfe, Gay Talese. I mean, there was this amazing crop of phenomenal writers that really threw out the who, what, when, why, you know, story of so-called objective reportage and decided to inject it filled with like the literary toolkit of quotation and allusion and stream of consciousness. And they threw themselves into their stories and they covered them in a way that no one really had. It's had a major impact on journalism. I think that that's a format that's been ubiquitously adopted now. So I think that George and his contemporaries in action journalism had a much bigger impact on changing a medium than any of the novelists of the mid-century. You know, I think Luke and I wouldn't have made a film about someone that we didn't think was a very good writer. But, you know, the way we had the film unfold was that we wanted to present it, hear the arguments, hear the criticisms of him, and just put his writing out there.
Tom Bean, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Cheers. Thanks so much for having us.
And Luke Poling, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Tom Bean and Luke Poling filmed, wrote, and produced the film Plimpton, starring George Plimpton as himself. For more on the film, including where it's screening, you can go to wordofmouthradio.org.
Applause began to sound from the stands, and I looked up, startled, and saw people standing and the hands going. It made no sense at the time. It was not derisive, it seemed solid and respectful. What? What, I thought. And I wondered if the applause wasn't meant for someone else. If the mayor had come into the stadium behind me and was waving from an open-topped car. Some of it was, perhaps, an appreciation of the lunacy of my participation. And for the fortitude it took to do it. But most of it, even if subconscious, I decided was in relief that I had done as badly as I had.